Blog Talk Radio.
3, 2, 1. Here's something you can't watch every day. A show about a show that flopped. And what a flop, involving Dana Carvey, Stephen Colbert, and Louis C.K., just to name a few. Hulu brings Too Funny to Fail your way next Saturday, and director Josh Greenbaum joins me next. First came The Story of God. Now Morgan Freeman documents the story of Us on National Geographic. Executive producer James Younger documents its formation later this hour. And also ahead, the answer to this week's classic trivia question. Hey everyone, I'm Simon Applebaum, live from New York on Blog Talk Radio. This just in, it's Friday the 13th, and tomorrow will be televised. Brought to you by Audible.com, a leading provider of spoken audio entertainment and information that will transform the way you hear the world. Listen to audiobooks whenever and wherever you want. Get a free book when you sign up for a 30-day trial at audibletrial.com/televised. More details later this half hour. Great to have you with us this Friday afternoon for the program All About Television, 1 hour later than normal, but I think you'll find an hour worth waiting for. Wonderful guests coming your way in the next 60 minutes, and we invite you to be as much a part of the program as they are. How do you do that? Raise your voice, pick up the phone, and use this number, 646-652-2906. That's 646-652-2906. That number's been anywhere, catches across the country and around the globe here on Blog Talk Radio. Our chat room is in business as well. It's SimonApple04 by name. You will find it at our homepage, blogtalkradio.com/televised. Our very good friend Rick Webb from Philly is in the room. And while the program is on the air, you can connect others by using Facebook Timeline. Click on the Facebook icon on your Blog Talk screen. Follow the instructions, and other people can be live with you. 65 degrees at the top of this hour here in New York, and joining us right at the start of the hour, our first guest, the director of the new Hulu special, Too Funny to Fail, from Los Angeles, Josh Greenbaum. Hi, Josh. Welcome in.
Hey, Simon. Thanks so much for having me.
It's a pleasure. Normally, when people do specials about television shows, TV about TV, if you will, is usually about a show that works. Probably a long-running show. Why did you and your colleagues decide to do a show about a program that not only didn't work, but flopped spectacularly?
It's a good question. First of all, I guess I vividly remember watching the Dana Carvey show. I was in high school. I was about 17, and I remember I was such a huge Dana Carvey fan. And there was a show coming out on ABC on prime time that was looked right up my alley, and I was so excited. And I sat down and remember their very first sketch, which we can get into in a little bit, but sort of blew my mind. I remember my parents watching it and both getting up and walking out of the room at the very first sketch of the show. It was not for them. And I think that made me sort of lean in a little bit closer to the show. But, you know, as a documentarian now, it's 21 years later, I kind of always wondered, what happened to that show? Why did it go wrong? It got pulled off the air very quickly. And I guess to really answer your question of why failure, I find that the greatest stories aren't always the ones of triumph. And specifically, the funniest stories are sort of rarely the tales of uplifting, you know, goal achievement or success. I think a lot about when you're at a dinner party, do you want to hear the story about the perfect vacation somebody had, you know, where everything went according to plan, or would you rather sort of relish in every detail of the trip from hell? And I think there's great comedy and drama in sort of epic failures, and this one's especially epic.
Well, when you speak of epics, this is an epic that a lot of people at the time, and we're talking the spring of 1996, thought this was going to be a slam dunk hit. Here you had Dana Carvey, one of the most popular Saturday Night Live people ever, the church lady, all the other characters he did on that show, red hot. He comes to ABC, a comedy variety show that is tailored to him. He gets apparently the supporting cast and the writers he wants. He gets PepsiCo as a sponsor, where every week a different PepsiCo product, whether it's Pepsi Cola, Mountain Dew, Diet Pepsi, Taco Bell, sponsors an episode. That in itself was an unusual breakthrough unto itself. And on top of all of that, he gets Home Improvement with Tim Allen as a sensational lead-in. So at that time, it was very popular, one of the most popular shows on television. First of all, how did Dana get the show on ABC?
He took it around. He partnered right away while he was at SNL, he met a guy named Robert Smigel. For those who know the comedy world, they know that name. But for the less initiated, Robert Smigel is, you know, one of the greatest sketch comedy writers of all time. He's also the guy behind Triumph the Insult Comic Dog. So it's his hand that's inside that puppet. But they partnered up, and they had this idea to do kind of an SNL-style show, but with more creative freedom. And they went and they shopped it around, as you often do with a show. And they went to all the major networks and ultimately landed on ABC, despite the fact that they wanted to really push the boundaries. I think Dana was, as you see in the doc, Dana was leaning more towards going with like an HBO. But at the time, HBO in 96 was not what HBO is now. There was no Game of Thrones. You know, it was the programming was not nearly as big and the audience not as big. So, of course, if you know, it's hard to turn down the largest audience possible with ABC. And as you pointed out, Simon, the number one show on television was called Home Improvement. Huge lead-in. So you've got 26 million people who are watching that show and then brought over to your show. So they ultimately, I think despite Dana's gut, as he points out, decided to go with ABC, which I think is, you know, one of many sort of missteps that started the rocky relationship that ultimately led to the demise of this, what should have been incredible, long-lasting show.
And was that the scene that everyone decided upon was this was a classic example of misfitting, you know, star and concept to network, first sketch to show, and on and on?
Yeah, there was just a lot. I mean, to back up a second, you know, to your other question, I think to let your listeners know who was on that show, which is sort of incredible to look back on and discover. This was the very first job ever of a young guy named Steve Carell. He was, well, not that young, as he was points out in the film. I mean, he was 35. He was living in Chicago, sort of realizing that his career may not ever happen. His agent even said to him, if you don't get something soon, you might want to give up, which is not what you want to hear from your agent. He gets cast in the film, in the show. His understudy at Second City Chicago was a no-name guy at the time named Stephen Colbert. It was his first job ever, and he was completely unemployed at the time, had a brand-new baby, was desperate for work. The head writer of the show was a 28-year-old, as they call it, kid in the film, and also unknown at the time, named Louis C.K. So he's your head writer. They hired other writers, Charlie Kaufman, who wrote Eternal Sunshine of the Spotless Mind and won Academy Awards, and Robert Carlock was his first job out of college, and he's the creator of 30 Rock with Tina Fey and Kimmy Schmidt. So you have this just incredible who's who of comedy behind the show, and then, yes, they made a little bit of a bold decision with their very first sketch right off the bat.
And that first sketch on the very first show, of the very first minutes of that program, involved Bill Clinton in a sort of uncompromising semi position.
Yes. Yeah. The way Robert Smigel describes it, he remembers he and Louis C.K. sort of sat down when they had a lot of different sketches they could kick the whole show off with. And they decided, as they put it, to draw a line in the sand and say, you're either with us or you're not, and we're going to let you know what this show is right away. And as Robert points out in the doc, that probably was not the best way to start the show. They did a sketch where Dana Carvey plays Bill Clinton, and he, for some reason, has decided he wants to become both father and mother to the country. I think Hillary was in trouble at the time, and so he was, whether or not she was going to be involved anymore, he says, I can be both father and mother. And to really prove that, I've had basically taken hormones and now have the ability to breastfeed. And he then begins to unbutton his shirt to not only reveal that he can breastfeed, to reveal that he has nipples implanted in his body. And he begins breastfeeding live puppies and kittens and babies on air as their very first sketch out of the box, out of the gate. And one of the amazing facts that I found, because we interviewed Ted Harbert, who at the time was the head of ABC, ABC paid for minute-by-minute Nielsen ratings and discovered that during that first sketch, you know, about 1 or 2 minutes into the show, they lost 6 million people from their lead-in of Home Improvement, all tuned out in the middle of that sketch. And I think it was a scramble to ever come back from that.
Including your mother, as we learned earlier in the show.
That's right. Although the Nielsens didn't record that because I kept watching, so that we can't count her.
Was the Dana Carvey show live? I know it was produced in New York, but was the show live or taped post air date?
It was a kind of a combination of live to tape. So they would pre-record sketches like that one, but then Dana would come out in kind of a variety show fashion in front of a live studio audience and do some intros, do some live sketches in front of a crowd, and then toss to certain sketches and clips.
Mm-hmm.
But yes, recorded in New York.
Yeah.
And also, I got the sense, catching some of the clips of your documentary, that Monty Python Flying Circus was an influence on, if not Dana, on a lot of people doing the show, that they wanted to go for that Monty Python, you know, sketch after sketch, hit you, if you didn't like this one, you may like the next one type of approach.
That's right. Yeah, that's exactly it. I think everyone involved in that show was clearly born out of that mentality. And a couple of the guys, Robert Smigel, who was the showrunner, he brought over Louis C.K. and a guy named Dino Stamatopoulos, who's another big name in comedy. And the three of them had created the Conan O'Brien show when it first started. And you remember that was kind of a bold show out of the gate that also had influences of Monty Python behind it. But, yeah, very much a little absurdist at times. And absolutely also they love the presentational style, which I love, of Monty Python. There's a couple sketches from the Dana Carvey show. One is called Germans Who Say Nice Things. And then you literally just see Steve Carell and Dana Carvey dressed as Germans with these sort of turtlenecks and jackets. And they just start shouting in German accents these very sweet things like, "That cloud looks like a pony." I can't do a German accent. Or, "Kevin was a very good babysitter." just sort of ridiculous lines. "You're not getting older, you are getting better." Very sort of odd and presentational. Really, really funny stuff that I unfortunately can't do justice to on your radio show, but you'll have to watch the doc and or the show, which are both on Hulu.
The documentary that Josh Greenbaum is talking about is Too Funny to Fail. It's Hulu's latest original special, premieres next Saturday. And we're speaking with the director, Josh Greenbaum, live from Los Angeles. This half hour on Tomorrow will be televised. Simon Applebaum, who is from New York, delighted to have you with us on this Friday the 13th of October 2017. If you have a question or comment for Josh, don't keep silent. Get it out. Just call 646-652-2906 or use our chat room, SimonApple04 by name. Rick Webb is in the room. Don't miss our two episodes coming your way at our regular time, 3 p.m. Eastern, noon Pacific next week. We have got some doozies for you. First up will be the son of Richard Dawson, the beloved host, original host of Family Feud, and he is going to be with us to talk about a very special program he executive produced that will be on the air next Friday night on Buzzer. That's Fremantle Media's original game show channel. It's called Game Changers, and explores the history and future of game shows from a very unusual perspective. That of the host of Jeopardy, as Johnny Gilbert would say, Alex Trebek. Gary Dawson joins us for Game Changers. He's our first guest Monday on Tomorrow We Televise. And on the second half of the hour, Lifetime has an original movie coming up that's very special and very important. It deals with a crisis that's still going on in Flint, Michigan. It's called Flint. It's directed by Oscar nominee Bruce Beresford of Chains of Mercies and Driving Miss Daisy fame. And we've got the writer of Flint, Barbara Shapinski, joining us live. It's all coming up Monday, 3 p.m. Eastern, New Pacific, right here on Tomorrow We Televise. And we'll tell you shortly about our 90-minute episode coming your way a week from today that is a stunner. Let me tell you who's on it, and we will shortly. Did Ted Harper say to Dana and the crew afterward, at that first episode aired, you know, "You guys are in trouble, you got to do something about this"?
Yeah, I think the network, Ted Harper, who was the president of ABC at the time, was great. I had a wonderful interview with him, and he said, "Look, you know, there's a degree when you have this job I have where you have to either say to these guys, no, go back and write something different, or let them do what they do best." And he said, I made the decision to let them do their thing to start things off and to disastrous results. They lost their sponsor. Although, as you pointed out, it was always supposed to be a PepsiCo sponsor, but each brand gets to do it, make its own decision. And Taco Bell, who was the sponsor of the first episode, not only bailed out of being the sponsor, but made a very big public sort of display of how they are no longer associated with the Dana Carvey Show. But Ted Harbert, yeah, he came down on the guys and said, listen, you know, this is, you got to come out. And Dana had to come out the second episode and make somewhat of an apology, although he, you know, he sort of did it in his own comedic way. About specifically the Clinton sketch. But what's sort of fascinating, what I sort of loved about these guys in this story is they kind of kept getting the offer or the demand to change, to, you know, to change what they were doing and maybe try a little bit softer approach. And as you'll see in the doc, I think that they just have the kind of personalities, Louis C.K., Robert Smigel, Carell Colbert, to just double down and just say, no, we're just going to keep on track and you'll see, this will work out. We will win everyone over. And they just kept going on the path that they were headed.
Mm-hmm. And as it turned out, 7 episodes were made. Actually, there's an 8th episode that I think was going to happen, but it was taken off because the show was canceled after 7. Did they, in fact, find their voice? Did they, in fact, look like, when ABC made the decision to cancel the show 6 episodes later, after the first one, that they were finally getting their rhythm, they were finally getting a voice, there was a sense of how this show was going to work?
Absolutely. I mean, I think like any show, it does take time often for a show to find its voice. I mean, if you go back right now and watch the pilot of Seinfeld, you can barely recognize the show. You know, they often take time, and they often take time to both creatively find their voice, but also for the network to come around and kind of discover and realize what the show is and then understand how to market it, how to position it. And I think both the creatives and the network had two very different ideas. But, yeah, I mean, and it, by the way, it always had a huge audience. Despite the fact that they lost 6 million people, you're still talking about carrying 19 or 20 million people, which nowadays is massive. You know, there's very few shows. I don't think there's any shows that get those kind of numbers anymore. Because we've got so many different outlets to watch things. But look, I think the creative of it, part of the reason why I think the doc exists is because what they made was special. It was unique. It's the kind of content that when you look back, it's evergreen. It's still funny. It's still interesting. It's relevant. You can see its influence on shows like Key and Peele and Chappelle's Show and things that, you know, sketch comedy that followed. And I think if it wasn't great, we wouldn't have made a documentary about it 21 years later. I think, you know, I think if they had just sort of maybe watered down what they were trying to do, maybe it goes on and lives for 2 or 3 or 4 years, but then no one's talking about it. So it's mm-hmm. it's special in its boldness, I think.
Why did ABC pull the plug? Did they think that the audience drop had not plateaued? Did they get any sense that the audience was starting to build up, that like the people doing the show, the audience was sort of also finding its appeal, starting to see that they could have a future?
Yeah, I mean, you'll see, I'm obviously trying to be a little cagey and not give away all of the answers here, but I think a huge, huge factor, if you, you know much about the TV industry or the entertainment industry period, is at the end of the day, it's about making money. It's, you know, you got to be making someone money. So I think where they really started to run into trouble was, even though creatively they were doing great and even though they actually had a good amount of eyeballs, they were really struggling with sponsorship. And part of the reason why, as you'll see in the film, is they not only did they have the title sponsor, like the Taco Bell Dana Carvey Show or the Diet Mug Root Beer Dana Carvey Show, they then would often start the episode off with a song about that brand, oftentimes making disparaging comments about the brand. You know, the intro of the Mountain Dew episode, they personify and start listing all of the chemicals in it, you know, yellow number 5 and sodium benzoate or whatever, and they all start diving into the Mountain Dew can. And then not 1 or 2 minutes later, they've got a sketch about, you know, Dana's asking Bill Cott, one of his fellow castmates, what does Mountain Dew look like? Clearly insinuating it looks like urine. So when you make those kind of choices, it's a little difficult to hold your sponsors. And if you're not bringing sponsors in, you're not making the network money. And ultimately, they're not going to keep you on air for much longer after that.
How easy or hard was it to get Dana and Stephen Colbert and Louis C.K., et cetera, to talk about what was, I guess at the time, not a great moment in their lives to see what they worked so hard on get canceled, even though now all these people have found a deeper, greater level of success in other things.
Yeah. No, it's a great question, and it was not easy. And I didn't expect it to be easy, but it's not common that people want to go back and relive and relish in their what you could ostensibly call a failure. Although I think when you watch the show, you realize in many ways it was a success. Certainly, when you look back at the show and realize how great it was. But yeah, the first piece of the puzzle was getting Dana on board, and I, through my, contacts and my agents, kind of got in touch and went backstage. I went to one of his shows here in L.A., and he's still doing all this great stand-up, and that was a thrill to see him do stand-up in his club in Santa Monica. And I went backstage and then met with him, and we went and had a beer, and I just explained what I wanted to do and how I was a fan and how much I loved it. And while he kind of seemed on board, it took quite a lot of time in conversations with him to get him fully on board, which I totally understand. I think, anytime you're having somebody make a documentary about either your life or one of your stories, you ultimately put an immense amount of faith and trust in the filmmakers to tell your story accurately, or hopefully the way you hope it will be told. So that took a little bit of time. I think Dana was the biggest piece of the puzzle. And then once Dana was on board, I think the rest of it fell a little bit quicker in place. I think, as you see in the film, Steve Carell and Stephen Colbert, as they say, they owe their entire career to this show. And they owe their careers to Dana and Robert Smigel for giving them this opportunity and putting them out there. That you'll see it literally directly is how they got their next job on The Daily Show, and which launched them into their next, the next step of their careers. So I think they have pretty fond memories despite its failure, and we're very down to do it. So it wasn't easy, but it just took time and letting my subjects get to know me and feel like they could trust me. So, and now I have the pleasure of saying I'm close with Dana, and he's as great and sweet and funny as you would hope. He's just a really wonderful man.
Too Funny to Fail is the story of a show that failed, but not ultimately with many of the people that show brought aboard for the very first time, like Steve Carell and Stephen Colbert and Louis C.K. We're talking about The Dana Carvey Show, which ran on ABC in the spring of 1996 for 7 very unique episodes. Jack Greenbaum is the director of Too Funny to Fail, which premieres next Saturday on Hulu, available on smart TV sets and smart TV devices. He's with us live from Los Angeles this half hour on Tomorrow Be Televised. Simon Applebaum, we do live from New York. You want to have a chance to talk with him, give us a ring, 646-652-2906, or use our chat room, SimonApple04. My name, somebody has given a ring, we'll get to that call shortly. Next Friday on Tomorrow Be Televised, 9 in addition at our regular time period, 3 p.m. Eastern, New Pacific, and we kick it off with Mario Van Peebles, yes, the son of the sensational independent filmmaker Melvin Van Peebles. He's had a wonderful career by himself, including directing the classic groundbreaking New Jack City, and now he's doing a series that's available Friday nights on Sci-Fi. It's called Superstition. Call it a gothic horror show. He'll tell about it live next Friday as our lead guest. Then we'll have more about Sci-Fi's new series, one newly and one back in its second season, from executive producer Chad Oakes of Van Helsing and Ghost Wars. And then we will answer the question, whatever happened to Missy Capture, the original co-star of one of the most popular shows in basic cable history, early on its history, Silk Stockings, the show that originally started as part of CBS's Crime Time After Prime Time. Missy Capture will be live with us, and we'll find out from her about what she's doing now, including getting into directing for motion pictures, a very unusual documentary. Will she do directing for television? We'll find out. Mario Van Peebles, Missy Capture, and from Van Helsing and Ghost Wars on Sci-Fi, executive producer Chad Oakes. That's our lineup next Friday, 9 edition. Don't miss it. 3 p.m. Eastern, New Pacific, right here on Tomorrow Will Be Televised. Let's get our call in right now. Hello, you're on Tomorrow Will Be Televised. What's your name and where are you calling from?
Hey, Simon. It's Rick Webb calling from Philadelphia.
Hi, Rick. I have a strong hunch you're going to be on this segment, so go right ahead and talk to Josh.
Hey, Josh. I'm wondering about the way they came out with that first kind of gotcha sketch, whether you think that in today's world that almost might be a good thing to do because of social media, and it would probably go viral and probably draw up twice as much actual news because people would be, can you believe what they did and all that, whereas like back then it just kind of came off as offensive.
You know what, Rick, I think that's exactly right. It's a great question. I think, yeah, you're right. Right now, because there are so many outlets, it's the challenge nowadays as a creator is to cut through the noise. How do you stand out? How do you get attention? And I think you're right. I think that's the kind of thinking that would and does work. What's interesting, the way Dana and Robert described it to me in retrospect, I think it was Robert who said, you know, as a stand-up comedian, they often say, don't do that. Like, don't walk out and be really loud or really bold, because it's if you make it harder, now you got to dig yourself back out and win over your audience. You already have the stage. I think that's the point, right? They already had the stage. They were given it. ABC, you've got 26 million eyeballs. Why not just ease people into the show? I think Colbert says it in the doc. He says, all people wanted was see Dana do an impression of Bill Clinton. That's all we had to do. But no, we had to be, as they call it in the doc, they said they like to be rebels in sweaters, which is a line Robert Smigel says. He loves rebels in sweaters, which he calls like Larry David, Jerry Seinfeld, Steve Martin, David Letterman. There's these guys who seem and look to be doing what everyone else is doing, but are actually doing it completely differently and being subversive, but they don't announce it. They don't announce how subversive and different they're being. So I think you're exactly right. I think that is the kind of decision that nowadays you get rewarded, but back then on network TV, clearly got punished.
Well, cool. Thanks for your answer, and I'm definitely checking this out. I'm already learning just from this, you know, radio segment, just learning so much already. What to do, what not to do. It's just you learn a lot more from the failures, unfortunately, than the successes. So thank you for doing this, and thank you, Simon.
You're very welcome, Rick.
Thanks,
have a good weekend. Rick, one of our friends in Philadelphia, right here on Kwame Televised. Does Dana want to get back into television at some point? For example, seeing what Louis C.K. has done, Colbert, Steve Carell has done with
yeah.
The Office, you know, Robert Carlock with Jimmy Schmidt and 30 Rock. Does he ever think about, hey, maybe I can go back and do my series, and whether it's something else?
Yeah, sorry. And he does. In fact, we I made another documentary, weirdly, just about that came out a few months back, also for Hulu, called Becoming Bond, which tells the story of George Lazenby, who was the one-time James Bond, and that's also on Hulu. And the reason that's relevant is I reenacted scenes in there, and I needed a scene from Johnny Carson, and I actually asked Dana, because I was now working with him and friends with him for this documentary, to play Johnny Carson. And he did an incredible job doing the scene where George Lazenby goes on Johnny Carson and says he doesn't want to do Bond anymore, even though they offered him six more, which is sort of one of the shocking facts about George Lazenby. And from there, Dana and I started talking creatively about other projects. And he's got a couple ideas cooking in the TV space that I'm hoping to work with him on, because I also do direct narrative stuff. I direct New Girl and Fresh Off the Boat and working on a narrative feature right now. And so I would love nothing more than to see Dana do something really cool in the TV space. And so he's got some things cooking up, and I hope to be a part of them, or at least help them bring them to life so we can all enjoy his talent again, because he is just such a sheer talent.
Yeah, for sure. And what's next for you in television, aside from the Lazenby special that Hulu will have soon?
Well, that one's actually already out. That doc came out a few months back. So this one's coming out, as you pointed out, in a week and a half. And then I've got some exciting feature stuff that I'm working on. So that's the film side. And then in television, I'm taking a couple TV shows out that I'll be pitching, not unlike the way Dana and Robert did 21 years ago, and taking them out to try to sell. And in the interim, I do direct as well. So this week, I'm actually directing an episode of Fresh Off the Boat, which is a really great show. And the couple weeks after that, I'm doing an episode of New Girl, which is another one of my favorites. And so yeah, just kind of keep creating, and then hopefully I like to bounce back and forth between both documentary and narrative. I find them both creatively fulfilling in very different ways, but they're all about telling great stories. So.
And this is definitely a great story. Too Funny to Fail premieres next Saturday on Hulu. Remember, it's available on most smart TV sets and on most smart TV set devices, whether it is Apple TV, Roku, Google Chromecast, NVIDIA Shield, TouchNet Wave, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. For more details about the program online, you can go to www.hulu.com. Once again, Too Funny to Fail about the Dana Carvey Show. It's on October 21st. And by the way, fresh off the boat, as you mentioned, it is on its fourth season now weekly on ABC. For more details about that show online, abc.com. Josh Greenbaum, great to have you with us. Let's get you back on the show soon to talk about Fresh Off the Boat, the unsuspecting things, and of course, any new TV projects you got. It's been a pleasure, a more than pleasure to have you on.
Thank you so much, Simon. This has been really fun, and thanks for getting word out about our film. I hope people watch it and enjoy it. But thank you, Simon. Appreciate it.
I hope so, too, and best of luck to you on your future efforts as well. It's been a pleasure. Take care.
All right. Bye-bye. Thank you.
Josh Greenbaum joining us live from Los Angeles here on Tomorrow Will Be Televised. We will have more, including our classic trivia question week and our second guest of the hour, after some words from the fine people at Audible.com. If you're in the mood for a very unusual tale, try this. Grant, how much do you know about one of the presidents of the 1800s? The one that came after Abraham Lincoln, you know, the one that helped win the Civil War but supposedly had a disastrous presidency. Well, you might be surprised after you hear Grant by Ron Chernier and narrated by Mark Brenhill. Why? Because there's a lot more to Ulysses S. Grant than you think. And you can start hearing about it, if you like, with a wonderful trial subscription to Audible.com. Audible.com is the leading provider of spoken digital entertainment and information. Over 180,000 titles to choose from. And you can listen on any device, including whatever you are hearing us on right now at Blog Talk Radio. Remember, sign up at audibletrial.com/televised. You get one free audiobook like Grant, or one of your choice. 1 month trial of the service. Great customer service as well, because Audible is owned by Amazon.com. So hear for yourself why Audible.com can transform the way you hear the world. Remember, it's a free audiobook and a 1 month trial. And all you got to do is go to audibletrial.com/televised and get yourself started. When we come back, our classic trivia question of the week. But first, we'll hear about Morgan Freeman's latest TV adventure, The Story of Us, which started this past week on National Geographic. We'll hear about it from James Younger, the executive producer, after we pause at the bottom of the hour for web identification. This is www.blogtalkradio.com. You're over the best internet radio on the planet, with more than 25 million listeners around the world every month and growing. It's your home for Wise Words with Darius. Check out those wise words tomorrow, 2 p.m. Eastern, 11 a.m. Pacific, only on Blog Talk Radio. And remember, the best of BTR is available to you 24/7 at YouTube.com. Welcome back to the second half of Tomorrow Be Televised on this Friday, the 13th of October, 2017. Simon Applebaum, who is live from New York, 65 degrees, top of the hour. Another great guest coming way along with the answer to this week's classic trivia question. So if you have a question or comment for our guest up ahead, give us a ring, 646-652-2906, or use our chat room, Simon Apple 04. My name, Rick Webb, our friend from Philadelphia, is still in the room. And I'll tell you what, our second guest just dropped off the line, so second guest, come on back with us at 646-652-2906, and we will put you on the air. In the meantime, let's get to the answer to this week's classic trivia question. We've had it available for 2 weeks. Unfortunately, nobody got it, so nobody gets our special gift for the week, which is the second, the last 2-hour version of Genius, the wonderful Emmy-nominated Nat Geo miniseries starring Jeffrey Rush as Albert Einstein, and The Showrunner, by our guest from a week ago, Chai Chermak, the legendary executive producer behind Ironside, The Bold Ones, and Chips. The question we've had these last 2 weeks, name the original sons of My Three Sons. We wanted either the full actor names or the full character names. One of our previous winners, Ed Barinhouse from New York City, did give us the first names of the characters, but not the full. So anyway, here were the answers. If you were going for the characters' names, there was Mike, Robbie, and Chip Douglas. Mike Douglas, Robbie Douglas, Chip Douglas, we would have taken their major names, Michael, Robert, or Richard. And the actors who played them, Tim Considine, Don Brady, and Stanley Livingston, back in 1960, when My Three Sons began a 12-year run, first on ABC, and then later on CBS. And some of those episodes, I believe, are available on YouTube. So once again, the answer is exactly to the question. Mike, Robbie, Chip Douglas, Tim Considine, Don Brady, Stanley Livingston, those are the answers to this week's classic trivia question. We'll have another question for you on Monday. We'll have the same prize as well, the 2-hour finale of Genius and The Showrunner by Cy Chermak. And if you're first with the correct answer, you can win. So remember, when you hear the question, email us, It's SimonApple04@yahoo.com. SimonApple04@yahoo.com. Please enclose your name and where you're emailing from. And if you're first with the correct answer, you can win those prizes. And if you missed Monday's episode, no problem. We will post it tomorrow morning. I'll post it, I should say, Tuesday morning on our Facebook page and on our Twitter handle at UBCSimonTWBT. That's at UBCSimonTWBT. Remember, when you hear the question, be in there and win. For most of the last decade, Morgan Freeman has been as much a presence on television as he has been everywhere else in his amazing career. First, it was Through the Wormhole with the Science Channel, and then last two seasons, The Story of God on National Geographic. And now he is back as of this past Wednesday with his latest Nat Geo series, The Story of Us. And joining us live right now is the executive producer of the program, James Younger. James, good to have you aboard.
Hi, Simon. Thank you for having me.
You're very, very welcome. What's it like to have someone like Morgan Freeman behind your show?
Behind and in front of my show? Great. It's he is such a weighty presence, a wise voice. He obviously is, you know, such a well-known person. He draws people to take part in the show that otherwise would be challenging to get. I mean, we filmed with three presidents in this series, including, you know, Bill Clinton. So it's been an amazing partnership.
When he tackles a subject, whether it's God, whether it is some of the unique corners of science, or in this case, how we come to be as a civilization, he doesn't take the easy answer. He doesn't take the easy direction. He really, really goes for it. How long has he thought about doing a program about civilization and how it is?
Well, I know Morgan for years has been wanting to do a story about the spread of human society from Africa. You know, he's fascinated with Lucy, with the Olduvai Gorge, you know, that whole story of the spread of a civilization. That's one of his long-term passions. You know, he also actually is fascinated with this idea of, like, how did life begin here on Earth? So we started to explore that and, talking about the origin of human civilization. And we kind of ended up with this series because we felt that a story about bones and digging up bones and archaeology and was going to be dry and a little bit boring. I mean, not boring in terms of content, but like, who do you speak to? You don't speak to bones. They don't talk back to you. So we wanted to engage with people of all cultures, all ways of life all over the world. And through those people, kind of give people the whole, the picture, the rich tapestry of human civilization. And in a way that tells you indirectly the story of how we came from our beginnings on the African savannah to where we are today, 7 billion of us.
James, when you and your colleagues plot out a program like this, do you have the topics already set and then you plug Morgan into, okay, this first journey is going to go here and the next journey is going to go there and you're going to discuss freedom with these people and then you're going to talk about peace with these people and then with other side, what it is to love your fellow human beings?
Yeah.
Or does it you just have Morgan go on the journey and then you figure out which episodes happen and which go where?
Well, it'd be nice just to go on a plane and not know where you're going and figure it out. But no, we definitely start with mostly the former. We try to map everything out. You know, we have our six episodes. We research pretty thoroughly and it takes a long time to find the people, the interesting stories, the fascinating people that we found in the series from, you know, people who grew up slaves in North Korea to a small village in southern Africa where they've been warring with their neighbors. I mean, it takes a lot of research to do that. Having said that, you know, I would say the series is probably 75% pre-planned and 25% up to fate. You know, you find things, you have a conversation, it takes you in a new direction, you change your plans a little bit.
When things happen up to fate, do they happen early on or is it later on in producing the series where, let's take things in this direction?
You know, yeah, I guess some of that is true. I mean, for instance, there's one episode this season that we were trying to make a film about creativity. And then we realized the creativity episode wasn't, we couldn't find enough dramatic action, you know, dramatic tension in it. So then we changed plans to do a film about belief. You know, we'd done the story of God, and we thought, well, there are lots of beliefs that make our society work, not just religion. We all believe in money. We all believe in nation. We believe in our tribes. And so we started trying to make this film, and it just wasn't really coming together. It felt like there wasn't a very strong through line. And then actually we had a conversation with President Bill Clinton. And we were talking to him about what we believe in. We were talking to him about tribalism as part of the film, how we break into tribes and we struggle to see people who are you know, in a different tribe from us. And that tribe could be like literally a, you know, an ethnic tribe, or it could be a political tribe or some other cultural tribe. You know, maybe you're on the left or the right in politics or something like that. We struggle to see these other people as really humans, as really like us. And Bill said, you know, we need to be able to include the story of them in the story of us. And that conversation gave us the idea, like, oh, we should be calling this film about tribal beliefs Us and Them, because now we're living in this time which is so divided into us and them. And so that's how that film, which is the fourth episode in the series, came to be that title.
Executive producer James Younger is with us this half hour on Tomorrow We Tell Lies. His latest project with Morgan Freeman and the fine folks of his company, Revelations Entertainment, is The Story of Us. Episode 2 is The Fight for Peace, and you can see it next Wednesday night at 9, 10 Eastern and Pacific Time on National Geographic. James joined us live this half hour on Tomorrow We Tell Lies, and we're happy you're joining us live on this Friday the 13th of 2017, October style. Simon Applebaum with you live from New York. If you have a question or comment for James, don't be shy. Make that phone call, 646-652-2906, or use our chat room, SimonApple04 by name. Coming up on Monday's episode at our normal time period, 3 p.m. Eastern New Pacific, we have the son of Richard Dawson, the very popular original host of Family Feud. Gary Dawson's with us, and he's got a special coming up next Friday called Game Changers. It's all about the history and the future of game shows with many of the major people in the field. And it involves a journey, you might say, of his own, like Morgan Freeman's journey, by the host of Jeopardy, Alex Trebek. Trebek is featured in the documentary throughout, and I think you'll find very, by the way, one of the things that is in that documentary, one of the last interviews with Monty Hall, who died 2 weeks ago. And we'll find out from Gary about what else he's doing in the game show field as well. By the way, Game Changers will be running on Buzzr, which is the Fremantle Media multicast channel all about game shows. This is their first original program, and some stations that take Buzzr on multicast will also run it in prime time or other times on their local stations. And we'll tell you who some of the stations are too. And on the second half of the hour, we've got the writer of Lifetime's very important movie coming up later this month called Flint. It is about the Flint water crisis, which is still going on. Barbara Chapansky will join us. That's coming up next Monday, 3 p.m. Eastern, New Pacific, right here on Tomorrow We'll Be Televised. Of all the topics that you had for The Story of Us, which was the most difficult to film?
Getting the interview with Bill Clinton was quite challenging, but that's just a production issue. I think it was very challenging to go and work in southern Ethiopia. You know, this is what called the tribal region of Ethiopia. So you're several hours flight south of Addis Ababa. We landed on a grass airstrip in the middle of this just bush area. And then you go through a region which is fairly, it's not easy to travel around there. There's a lot of all the shepherds or the guys who are tending their cows carry AK-47s with them, and if you can't just wander around there without a security team. So we had to go in with a security team. We get to a very remote village. It's very hot, very dry, and the village was kind of amazing. It's like these people, the Dasenech, they live in these low kind of wood twig huts, which are covered in animal skins. And actually, because they've been having a drought down there, they don't have enough grass to cover their huts. So they cover them with like corrugated metal, like corrugated tin roofs. So it looks like a kind of a, almost like a Mad Max set, you know, this kind of very rustic and a kind of like a rusted post-industrial look to it. That was a pretty amazing setting. And then they had, you know, they were sacrificing a cow that day and smashing it on the head with a stone. That was quite you know, surprising to watch. Cutting its stomach open and smearing themselves with the grass of the cow's stomach. So, yeah, that's kind of an example of some of the more unusual settings to be taking Morgan Freeman and a film crew.
Mm-hmm. Well, the other thing you got coming up this Wednesday is the Fight for Peace, where you go to places like Rwanda and Bolivia to see how they deal with, in some cases, ongoing civil war or wars that, or battles, skirmishes that pop up every now and then. And it's very fascinating you raise this question, which is, if you don't have war, do you have mm-hmm. do you have peace? Or is there something really different? And I'm curious, when Morgan went to, and you and everybody went to do that episode, I'm curious what kind of answers people had. Did people sort of get confused by the question when Morgan posed mm-hmm. it directly to them? They think like, hey, we don't have war, we should have peace. And it comes across as like, well, maybe not so fast.
Well, I think it was kind of interesting to hear people answer that question, because for instance, in the last half of that film, we go first to Northern Ireland, where we met a Catholic man and a Protestant woman who had become friends. And it's actually, even though Northern Ireland is, ostensibly been at peace for, 20 years, since the Good Friday Accord, there's been no actual fighting there. And yet there are walls that are all over the city, walls, big 40-foot high walls separating Catholic and Protestant neighborhoods. Those walls are still there. And for this Catholic man and Protestant woman to be friends is potentially risking their lives. So there's an example of where absence of war is definitely not peace. Those people are not living in peace. They're living without war, but that's not the same thing. In Rwanda, on the other hand, you've got this, the in the wake of the genocide there in 1994 between the Hutus and the Tutsis, a million people, mostly Tutsis, were killed within just 3 month period. The President Kagame, who was a Tutsi, kind of invaded the country from, he was in exile, and he came in and took over and ended the war quite quickly. But how do you recover from that? I mean, it's a population of about, I think the population of Rwanda is maybe 8 or 10 million people. So 1 million people died. That's like, a tenth or an eighth of the country killed. And you would think that it would be like Northern Ireland times 100, how do you ever get over that? How do you stop being at each other's throats, wanting revenge? And that was what was remarkable about being there, was finding this level of reconciliation that had happened, which was organized by the government, but then embraced by the people to say, we have to reach out and make peace with our former enemies. We filmed a couple. Maria is a woman who, during the genocide, her husband and her children were chased out of their village. She escaped. They were militia were approaching them. They broke up. They split up into two groups. She was with one of her children. Her husband was with the other children. Her husband and two other children were killed. She survived with her daughter, I believe. And years later, through this reconciliation process, she met one of the men who killed the rest of her family. He was a young man at the time. He was 16 or 17. He was caught up in this kind of craziness of the genocide, probably didn't fully know what he was doing. And he reached out to her and asked for forgiveness. And over a course of 2 years, she did forgive him. And now they're friends. I mean, he comes and helps her feed her cow every day. They look after each other. So that's just an amazing story of how to make peace in the wake of terrible form of war that, you can think of.
And what you just said, by the way, is a great segue to an episode you have 2 weeks later that deals with us and them. And it is a very, very current topic, because one of the things you hear about a lot these days with our society here in the United States is polarization, that we are polarized, that we are divided, that we have red and blue states, we have this and that, we have for Donald Trump, anti-President Donald Trump. And how do you explore this idea of, you know, how do we live in divided societies or supposedly polarized societies?
Yeah. It's very hard, right? I mean, you have to – people do have different cultural ways of life. You might live in the countryside and you might think, oh, having a gun and is really important to me and I want a gun. You might live in the middle of a city and you might think having a gun is a terrible thing, you know, and – Those are different views of the world. They're both valid for where they are, you know. And so we've got to somehow figure out how to see the reason why people choose to live their lives one way or another. But it's becoming increasingly hard, and that's why we made the film. Someone I think is really stands out in this story for me is Megan Phelps Roper. Do you know who she is? She was in the Westboro Baptist Church.
Mm-hmm.
She is actually the granddaughter of the founder of the Westboro Baptist Church. The Westboro Baptist Church is famous for, you know, campaigning with those signs saying God hates fags and going to the funerals of American soldiers and protesting them and doing these, you know, terrible, heinous things in the name of a very, very kind of cultish, perverted form of Christianity. And she grew up in that church. She's all she ever knew. And she would engage on social media in these terrible flame wars with other people. And then one day she got into an argument on Twitter with a Jewish guy who lived in Israel. His handle was Jewlicious. And she got into an argument with him about scripture, they managed to start actually talking to each other rather than talking over or shouting at each other. They managed to engage in conversation. He managed to persuade her that what she was, some of the principles she was espousing were contradictory. You know, there were parts of scripture that contradicted others. How could you promote death and hate to people if you also promoted, forgiveness? And she just by calm conversation, they managed to really start communicating. And it actually led her to leave the Westboro Baptist Church. And so now she is, you know, she's someone like Megan is a great symbol of hope, I would say, is a source of hope that, you know, we can come together. You can bridge divides that seem impossible through understanding the other person's point of view, taking the time. And actually that social media, which now we see as maybe as adding fuel to the fire of division, can be used to the opposite effect. It just takes this kind of patience and ability to see, just try to put yourself in other people's shoes.
The Seven of Us with Morgan Freeman happens Wednesday night at 9 o'clock Eastern Pacific Time on the National Geographic Channel and is available the next day on smart TV sets and smart devices through Amazon Fire TV and Amazon Prime. We've got executive producer James Younger with us live this half hour on Tomorrow Be Televised. Simon Applebaum with you live from New York. Still time for maybe a question. If you jot it in and call it in at 646-652-2906. Or use the chat room, Simon Apple 04 by name. Big 90-minute episode coming your way a week from today. We kick it off with none other than acclaimed actor, writer, director, producer Mario Von Peebles, whose newest work is the new sci-fi series that premiered early this month called Superstition. Then we'll tackle two more sci-fi series from the same executive producer, Chad Oakes. Those series, Van Helsing now in season 2, Ghost Wars now in its rookie season. And finally, the original co-star of Silk Stockings, Mindy Kaptur, will be live with us to wrap that 90-minute edition up. She's now working on her first directing feature. Will she direct for television? We'll find out from her live right here, 3:30 Eastern New Pacific, a week from today on Tomorrow We Televise. We got a few minutes left, James. What is Morgan looking at doing with his production company when it comes to television? What TV projects are in the future?
Well, we have a few projects in the pipeline, and nothing that we're doing currently a show on scripts on the cooking channel about the history of food, which is really fun, with Michael McKean. That's our third season. We have some other great new projects in the pipeline with National Geographic. We have some scripted projects in the pipeline. Of course, you know, we're doing Madam Secretary on CBS on Sunday nights. So we are, but in terms of story of us, yeah, we're certainly planning more global explorations of humanity, in a sense. The story of God, story of us are both about what it means to be on this earth and what we're doing here and how we've got to be here. We definitely have more projects in the pipeline in that vein that we'll be ready to announce fairly soon.
And on that note, we will let you know once again, the story of us continues next Wednesday, 9 p.m. Pacific time, episode 2, The Fight for Peace, on the National Geographic Channel. Check the locals for where NatGeo is available in the area on cable and satellite. For more news, let's give more details about the program online. Go to NatGeoTV.com. It's NatGeoTV.com. And once again, day after, it's available on Amazon Prime and also through smart TV sets and devices that have Amazon Prime, or use Amazon Fire TV. Executive Producer James Younger, thank you again for joining us. It's been a pleasure all the way. Good luck to you, Morgan, Laura McCrea, everybody involved in Revelations, for the remainder of the series, and hopefully many more wonderful series, scripted and unscripted, to come. And I should point out, again, Madam Secretary, now in its latest season on CBS, comes on Sunday nights after NFL football, 60 minutes, etc. Check your local list of the CBS station in your area, CBS.com, more details about the show. Again, James, thank you for joining us, and all the very best to you, Morgan, Laura, and everybody involved with Revelations.
Thank you very much, Simon. It was a pleasure to be here.
You got it. We're welcome back anytime. Have a wonderful weekend.
Thank you. All right. Goodbye.
James Younger joining us live from Revelations Entertainment and the story of us with Morgan Freeman here on Tomorrow's Televised. Thanks to both of our guests for a wonderful Friday the 13th hour, and all of you for listening in. Remember, coming up on Monday, we will have Gary Dawson, the son of Richard Dawson, with Game Changers. He's the executive producer of Buzz TV's first original program, and Buzzer happens on multicast channels that includes the digital signals of broadcast stations and on cable channels throughout the country. And it premieres next Friday. Also, the writer of the new Lifetime movie Flint, about the Flint water crisis, directed by Oscar nominee Bruce Beresford, Barbara Stepanski, will join us. And again, coming up next Friday, 90-minute edition, we will have Mario Van Peebles from Sci-Fi Superstition, Chad Oakes, executive producer of Sci-Fi's Van Helsing and Ghost Wars, and Missy Capture, the former radio co-star of Silk Stockings. That was a great late night hit on CBS, then a big basic cable hit, Primetime, on USA Network, now on her own, directing her first feature. Missy Capture, Marion Peoples, Chad Oaks, all next Friday, 3:30 news right here on Tomorrow Televised. Came in on the show late, want to catch up on episodes you missed, blogtalkradio.com/televised. Also, check out the podcast version on iTunes and Apple TV's iTunes podcast app. If you don't have Apple TV, go to an Apple store near you or order it online. Love to hear what you think about today's episode and what your thoughts on where TV is at and where it is going. Email me, simonapple04@yahoo.com. That's simonapple04@yahoo.com. Find me on Facebook. Follow me on Twitter at UBCSimonTWBK. We appreciate what you have to say, because what you say matters. The views expressed in this program are those of the participants, not necessarily those of Blog Talk Radio. Our production associate is Candace Williams, and he tells Blog Talk Radio's general manager, with Jay Sonnenberg, executive content producer. The co-founders, Alan Levy and Bob Cherish. Tomorrow We Televise is brought to you today by Audible.com and Amazon Company. Remember, Audible transformed the way you hear the world. But Tomorrow We Televise, I'm Simon Applebaum in New York. Have a great rest of your week and your weekend. Back with you Monday at our regular time, 3 p.m. Eastern, New Pacific, you know where, Blog Talk Radio. And remember, whatever you're doing this weekend, make sure you're safe and great about it, okay? Okay. Until the next time, stay well and stay tuned.